with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.
The headlines this hour: Israeli bulldozers backed by troops demolished two Palestinian homes at a neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds. The Afghan government and a group of political leaders agree to form a joint command center for public uprising forces in the fight against the Taliban. And China's coronavirus cases hit a seven-month high as the Delta variant challenges Beijing's grip on the pandemic. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli bulldozers have demolished two residential apartments belonging to Palestinians in occupied East Al-Quds. The apartments were located in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds. A few days ago, Israel also razed to the ground several Palestinian homes and shops in the occupied West Bank. The regime routinely demolishes Palestinian structures in the occupied territories, alleging that they lack construction permits. That is while such documents are nearly impossible to obtain. Palestinians say that the demolitions are part of Israeli efforts to expand its settlements that are illegal under international law. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office to announce the start of an international campaign to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The protest brings to the spotlight the condition of Palestinian detainees, especially those under the illegal administrative detention without any trial. Ruba Shabit reports from Gaza.
The Prisoners Committee for the National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip is holding a series of events, including an international campaign demanding an end to the illegal policy of administrative detention practiced against Palestinians in Israeli jails. The protest was held in front of the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross, that came along with a conference in the West Bank.
Detainees under the administrative detention don't have any charge and they don't know why they are arrested. They can't have a lawyer and they don't know when they are going to leave the jails. There are detainees who spent more than 10 years with no legal charge. Most administrative detainees are on a hunger strike defending their right to freedom. We are holding a campaign to tell the detainees that they are not alone.
The illegal administrative detention policy allows the Israeli regime to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial and prevents them from having a lawyer.
Today, Palestinians are protesting here against inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention practiced against our people with no charge. Supporting the Palestinian detainees and their issue is a priority for us. We call on all human groups to stand by the detainees and bring an end to Israel's administrative detention.
Since the beginning of August, 17 Palestinian detainees have begun a hunger strike to protest against their administrative detention. Palestinians have called on the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue and stop the illegal policy to save the lives of Palestinian prisoners.
The administrative detention policy totally contradicts international law and violates human rights. I personally was suffering from this illegal policy for 3 years inside Israeli jails, and I can tell you the tragedy administrative detainees live with. Being arrested with no charge and having no court for an unknown number of years are what administrative detainees suffer from. Unfortunately, the human rights groups and the international community are aware of this tragedy, but don't move a stone.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees, who are arrested with no charge amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Iran has once again rejected the U.S. and U.K. allegations that the Islamic Republic was behind a recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations, Zahra Ershadi, dismissed the accusations as politically motivated and unsubstantiated. She was responding to anti-Iran statements by the U.S. and the U.K. in a Security Council meeting on Monday. Ershadi said that there is no verifiable and conclusive evidence to substantiate the accusations, calling them the repetition of fabrications by the Israeli regime. She noted that the regime that has carried out attacks on over 10 commercial vessels in regional waters in the last 2 years cannot whitewash its terrorist acts with such accusations. Ershadi urged the Council to avoid being trapped by the fabrications of the Israeli regime, which, as usual, are blindly supported by certain Western countries. Author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman says the U.S. and its allies have so far failed to provide clear proof backing their accusations against Iran.
When Iran says, well, fine, let's see some proof that we did this, the United States and its running dogs simply can't manage it. Dominic Raab, the British Foreign Secretary, is a Jew and presumed Zionist, and his counterpart in the United States, Anthony Blinken, is also a Jew and presumed Zionist. And they've got their poodles walking along behind them, the rest of the European countries, Germany, France, and so forth. And they don't bother to say, well, where is the proof? It's kind of like a parrot with a mental problem. It's, you know, we have proof, we have proof, we have proof. And when you say, well, show us the proof, all you get back is, we have proof, we have proof, we have proof. So it's very similar to the uproar that the Americans and the British and the Saudis orchestrated when there were attacks on Saudi oil refineries in the Eastern province. And attacks by Yemenis on various Arab installations in Saudi Arabia. And they were always, oh, this is Iran, this is Iran, this is Iran. And denigrating entirely the ability of the Yemenis to fight back against their Saudi oppressors.
An Israeli submarine has reportedly crossed the Suez Canal into the Red Sea as tensions are rising over a recent attack on an Israeli-managed tanker off Oman. Israeli warships have also reportedly entered the Red Sea, which are probably escorting the submarine that is moving stealthily. For more on that, earlier we were joined by our guest in the News Review program to discuss it with more details.
Time now for our News Review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. An Israeli Dolphin-class submarine has reportedly crossed the Suez Canal into the Red Sea amid rising tensions over a recent attack on an Israeli-owned tanker off Oman. An informed Iranian security source said two Israeli warships have also entered the Red Sea, adding that they are probably escorting the submarine, which is moving stealthily. The source stressed that the Israeli military's move is aimed at creating tensions in the region. Tel Aviv and its Western allies blamed Iran for the tanker attack without providing any substantial evidence. Tehran has already denied the accusation and has warned that it would respond decisively to any move against its national interests. Well, joining us is Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert from Madison, and we also have Lawrence Davison, former lecturer at Westchester University, joining us out of Westchester. Lawrence, if I start with you, how grave a mistake would it be for Israel to enter into any form of aggression with Iran?
Well, of course, it would be a major mistake, but not from their perspective. Anything that will drag the U.S. after it into conflict with Iran would be viewed as a positive thing from their perspective. And so while the move of the submarine is definitely an act of intimidation, we really don't know how far we can say it's a bluff. Because we don't know exactly how far Biden has given his okay to this or how far he'll back them. But for sure, they're trying to intimidate Iran. And they're also presenting a a situation which the Western media can present Israel as acting in defense of its interests, and as Iran as the aggressor. And it doesn't matter if there's any evidence. You know, evidence is not a necessary requirement for the media. And so, you know, we have this bit of drama. But I wouldn't underestimate the nutsiness, the craziness of the Israelis. If they get a chance to drag the Americans into something, they'll do it.
Kevin Lawrence there basically saying, you know, the, Israel is trying to get the United States to fight a war on its behalf, of course, using American taxpayers' money. But, you know, how would, you know, if that backfires against Israel, what would the effects be on Israel, Israel itself, the on the in the occupied territories, on its vital infrastructure there? And essentially, you know, the Israeli settlers that live in the occupied territories, as well as American interests and bases that are all within Iranian range of Iranian missiles.
Yeah, they're playing with fire. They have been trying to drag the U.S. into a war, and they've partially succeeded with the 9/11 false flag, which I believe was partly orchestrated by pro-Zionist forces in the U.S. and partly by hardline militarist imperialist forces. They were going after regime change in seven countries in 5 years, as we learned from General Clark, and the seventh and most important country on that list was Iran. The Israelis hoped to get the U.S. Fighting big time and trying to invade Iran within just a few years. I guess 5 years was the original plan. And then just at the end of the Cheney-Bush regime in 2007, there was a flurry of activity aimed at ginning up a pretext for the U.S. to go to war with Iran. A false flag was arranged off Bahrain, and it came very close to actually happening. And so then there was backlash. The realist faction here in the U.S. realizes that this is folly and has stood against these Israeli attempts to start a war between the U.S. and Iran. But currently, I think the Israelis are obviously trying with some success to sabotage the JCPOA, and they may have more in mind. They're still smarting from their defeat in 2006 at the hands of Hezbollah, a pillar of the Axis of Resistance, and the Israelis blame Iran for that, as well as Hezbollah, and they've been looking for a way to try to get some kind of revenge or to try to go for another round and hope they could do better. But the problem is that they're faced with increasing numbers of increasingly accurate missiles. And Hezbollah has an incredible missile arsenal now, vastly beyond what they had in 2006. And Hamas is getting one too. And the Israelis blame Iran, but they are in a position where, they, as you said, suggest, if they actually were to start a big war with Iran, Israel would have a real hail of missiles coming down on it. And if the Americans got involved, then they would start losing bases. Iran has shown that it can pummel American bases with extreme accuracy. We saw that after General Soleimani's assassination. So the Americans know that war with Iran would not be a good idea. The Israelis know it wouldn't be a good idea unless they can get the U.S. to fight for them. So it's really kind of what we sometimes call a Mexican standoff, and I hope it remains that way.
Let's thank our guests. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Kevin Barrett is an author and a Middle East expert joining us out of Madison. Lawrence Davison, former lecturer from Westchester University, joining us out of Westchester. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. And that brings an end to this edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. The Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and a group of political leaders have agreed to form a joint command center to mobilize public uprising forces against Taliban militants. The presidential palace said that the center will oversee rapid equipment and the mobilization of the forces in various parts of Afghanistan. The command center will have key political leaders as its members. The Taliban have seized six provincial capitals in less than a week. They are now focused on Mazar-e-Sharif. That is a major city whose collapse gives the militants total control over northern Afghanistan. The fighting has forced thousands of civilians from their homes. Many of them are seeking refuge in the capital, Kabul. Our correspondent, Kabul, Amin Alami, gives us details about the decision to establish a force of volunteers to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan.
This decision by the Afghan presidential comes as earlier the Afghan president and his national security advisor, Hamdullah Muhib, and some of the other prominent political leaders inside the Afghan government have rejected a proposal of establishing a public armed front against the Taliban militants. They were arguing that establishing such front will further wage the war in Afghanistan, and bringing them under the control of a united leadership would be a very difficult job. Now, with the rise of militants' attacks all over Afghanistan, particularly in on big cities, the Afghan government have realized to say yes to such move. Currently, fightings are underway in the suburbs of Mazar-e-Sharif, the northern city in Afghanistan, but Afghan security forces plus public armed fronts have successfully pushed back those attacks. They are saying that we have killed over 300 Taliban militants over the past 24 hours just in northern Mazar-e-Sharif, in the suburbs of northern Mazar-e-Sharif city. In the meantime, the commander of 2015 Afghan National Army Corps in the southern Afghanistan, who is responsible for the security of the entire southern region of Afghanistan, said that a number of 800 Taliban militants, including some foreign nationals, have so far been killed as a result of fierce fightings between Afghan forces and Taliban militants inside some key parts of the city of Lashkar Gah, that is the capital of southern Helmand province of Afghanistan.
China's coronavirus cases have surged to a seven-month high after a cluster at a test site helped drive up numbers. Health authorities confirmed 143 new infections Tuesday, 108 of them locally transmitted. Dozens of cases in recent days have been linked to a COVID testing site in the eastern city of Zhengzhou. Chinese media say the current outbreak is the worst in the country since the virus emerged in the central city of Wuhan in late 2019. The ongoing outbreak has triggered lockdowns, mass testing, and travel restrictions nationwide. China largely contained COVID-19 in the past months. Now its grip on the pandemic is facing challenges as the Delta variant spreads. And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded police chief Darryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon, Jadu, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
Not. You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me to go save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
It doesn't seem real.
It felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity. Empowerment. They're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that, and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, it obviously ups the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement. But it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story. And I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. Mm. So you start hearing from people. You might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before you, otherwise you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, mm-hmm. or, you know, violent African American. And of course what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories, and I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories, and I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it a riot. I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place, which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment mm-hmm. that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this context, this build-up is very important.
The context is absolutely critical. I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city. It still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know, and underneath the surface, that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's unmasked it, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms is being told through different eyes, mm-hmm. what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent, mm-hmm. and people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean, youth.
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that a bit more detail later on.
Sure.
One of the many issues that came up during his time as a chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
There was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates. And of course, we learned a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments, and he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reaction watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific, and Darrell Gates. I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years, and so this the film goes over. You know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darrell Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who's very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is you know, you can't justify it in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it. But you know, you go, okay, well then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now again,
it's
really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you might have seen in the past.
And Suresh, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated. People are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying it. I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apology was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like Southam, which is where I come from, which is Harare, right, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people. I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. Mm. And they used a lead gauge baton to kill him in 1979. Mm. In Mark Duggan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprising didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American, mm-hmm. It's a very, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very, he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community, mm-hmm. With 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote
the
screenplay
for.
Yeah, him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual kind of, mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy, usually, and stirring things up. And I felt that this was a much more restrained and, trying to be more empathetic to look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and nearly killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, empathetic thing. And again, without letting anybody off the hook, and there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of
doubt. Well, of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Mm. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, some sort of, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos.
But
it obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. Public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues. And one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victim instead of the perpetrator.
There's a time bomb that comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and it's gone, nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not hurt, and after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, mm-hmm. which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. But in the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times mm-hmm. to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think they called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm-hmm. And we've in BRICS.
So we'll just pause there for now. John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
that, yeah.
You know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I don't even mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, that's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know, I mean, we just know that there are issues, whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, mm-hmm. whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up, you know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism mm-hmm. stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Natasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. Mm-hmm. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson Inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they haven't, they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability for police force. The manner in which police always, almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal looting, the police officers walked free.
They walked free in Rodney King's case, as far as the district was concerned. But obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court, the subsequent trial. And there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole but criminal justice
so,
system.
The differences are that just the Black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance or Black power politics, is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the Black community just as important as the Black, as the Americans would do in terms of Black. For example, people like Huey Newton in the Black power movement, there are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Totem Riots, mm-hmm. which is a fascinating, moving film mm-hmm. of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts to be made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that Black communities have in their communities, young people, mm-hmm. women, and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I think, I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which, mm-hmm. again, covers similar things. But it really is, when people actually, it's proper journalism. And it's also good filmmaking. And when you put those together, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding. And then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, change things in the future.
Mm. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Considering the fact that we are in the month of Muharram, a very sad month on the hearts of the believers, a month which a tragedy that has never been experienced throughout history has taken place in this month. Therefore, we commemorate and we lament the martyrdom of our master, Al-Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salamullah. So we thought it's only befitting to speak about Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salam and his stand for humanity. As we understand that there are many personalities throughout history who acclaimed to be the champions of human rights or fighting for humanity in general. However, the true hero of human rights is none other than Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salam. History have never seen anyone stand for the rights of people, for the rights of humans, as much as Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salam. And Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salam, to make that statement that he's a champion and hero of human rights, he actually sealed that deal with his pure blood, not only his, but those of his family and his companions, which is a sacrifice that not many people are willing to give for the sake of humanity. Where we see Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he went willingly to stand up against oppression and to bring life back into people and make them feel as human beings, as we will see later on. So inshallah, we will look at human rights from the scope, from the view of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. What did he do for humanity? What did he give to humanity? What does his sacrifice mean for humanity? So we will take you on a trip back to history a little bit so you can get a grasp of the environment and the reality that existed at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And mind you, not much have been changed. If you compare our current life to the life of Imam Hussein or the environment of Imam Hussein, it is very much similar. Maybe things have changed when it comes to the looks of them, but the nature is still there. Oppression still exists. And that's why every time we commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, it's not that so we can cry, not that so we could beat our chests, but the fact is what? That we need to live the values of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We need to live the codes of practice that he brought forward. We need to live the ideas and the ideology that Imam Hussein stood for, which is obviously, in a simple term, to give human beings back their right and to make them fight for their right. So we have to walk in the path of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and we have to fight our way, even if it means we have to give our blood, our money, our time for that cause, because it is a very valuable cause. So we will talk about Imam Hussein alayhi salam and human rights, but first let us take a short break and then we come back, so don't go anywhere.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters.
and you are listening to IRIB English Radio, listening to For Humanity. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when he rose up to defend humanity, though there was a tyrant by the name of Yazid ibn Muawiyah, which I'm sure you have heard of and you know already. Before we get to understand what did Imam al-Hussein stand for or why he stood against Yazid, we need to understand who Yazid was and what was he doing so bad that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had to fight him. Because most of the times we look at the battle, we look at what took place in Karbala, but we fail to look at why and the main reasons to why. So Yazid, may Allah curse him, he was the son of Muawiyah. When his father passed away, he passed the rulership and the leadership to his son Yazid, even though he made a treaty with Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam that it goes to Imam al-Hussein if Muawiyah died, which Muawiyah broke that treaty, as we all know. Yazid himself, as a person, he was known to be a corrupted person to the last level. He was corrupted morally and he was corrupted socially. So when it comes to him as a person, he used to indulge in alcohol, in fornication, even in some historical facts, he used to commit incest with his mother and, God forbid, other family members. He used to play with monkeys, he used to have dogs, and he used to have servants for his dogs. So each dog that he has, he would appoint a servant to serve that dog. So you can see, as a person, he was morally corrupted to the last extent. Now, when you have such a personality that is corrupted to that extent, and you place him in a sensitive role as leadership, then you know that the society and the community that this person would lead will get corrupted itself as well. So when he became in power, when he took power as well, he started creating havoc in the Muslim nation. One of the first things that he did, he established what we call today nightclubs. He established places where people indulge in sins. That was one of his merits, if we can say the least. And then he took power and he was thirsty for blood. According to some historians that I've read myself, they said that he used to enjoy, he used to get the satisfaction within him when he sees people being killed or people being punished or people, suffering. It used to give him a sensation of pleasure. This is the man that led an ummah or led a nation. So when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he saw that Yazid, a person who's corrupted on a moral level, on a social level, is being appointed as a king, then Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, if I allow this to happen, then that person will not only become an oppressor himself, but he will oppress the rest of the people. He will take the rights of others. He will kill as much as he wishes. Therefore, I have to make a stand. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he stood against Yazid for that notion, because he was an oppressor that will take the rights of people. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in the process, gave what he gave. Now, this is just an intro, inshallah, to what we will be talking about later. So I will leave you with this, inshallah, and we will continue in episodes to come. So until then, take care of yourselves. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.